And away we go. Hey. All right, levers. So I talked a little about levers associated to certain things that we use in day-to-day life, such as scissors. So, of course, you have to think a lever is something that can overcome resistance larger than the magnitude of the effort applied, such as, you know, moving a stone with a stick and a rock sort of thing. And to increase the speed and range of motion through which a resistance can be moved. So I use the example of the head of a driver of a golf club, and it's getting faster as you move through. So there is a rigid bar to them. Now, basically, they use a small force to overcome a relatively large resistance in a short distance. So that's the whole point of most of those. We have to remember that, you know, when we look at a joint in a body, we have two bones that interact with each other, and that is called an articulation or a joint. And of course, we already know that, you know, the rule is a muscle must cross a joint in order to affect it, right? So we're saying here that every bone in the body can be looked at as a rigid arm and therefore part of a lever. The joint is the fulcrum and the contracting muscles is or are the force. So we have, you know, wherever there's a joint, we have our fulcrum. Think of it kind of like an axis, but like a triangle. So, you know, teeter-totter at that midpoint. And then, of course, the muscle provides the energy or the force to move something. So when we look at it, we say, you know, we have lever arms. So this is defined as the portion of the lever between the fulcrum and the force points. So again, we've got something that is creating force and something that has the load with the fulcrum, in this case, in the middle. So the effort arm is the distance between the fulcrum and the effort point. Effort meaning, in our case, say, for example, contraction. And then the resistance arm is the distance between the fulcrum and the resistance point, which could be a dumbbell, a box, a rock, or anything like that. There are a number of arrangements that can occur between the three points of a lever. So again, we've always got a moment or effort arm, a fulcrum, and a resistance arm. Every lever has that, no matter what. So if we say a lever, you have effort, resistance, and a fulcrum. It's where they are in relationship to each other that determines whether it is a first class, second class, or third class. Okay? So, first class. The axis lie or fulcrum lies between the effort and the resistance. The mechanical advantage here is balance. So think of a teeter-totter. So a teeter-totter is a first class lever. You've got the movable part in the middle. You've got kids sitting at each end. Right? That is considered a first class lever. It can also be used to magnify the effects of the effort or to increase the speed or range of motion on the basis of the relative length of the effort arm and the moment arm. So when we're looking at the length of those, if they're equidistant from the fulcrum, it's going to be sort of somewhat equalized, balance. If we make the effort arm longer, it takes less energy to move the resistance. If we make the resistance arm longer, it takes more energy to move the resistance or the weight. Everybody got follow me? Right? So depending on where that fulcrum is in relationship, because the teeter-totter we always use as an example for first class, well, the fulcrum is right in the center and you have equidistance from that point, whatever child's on there, right? So if I've got a rock that I want to move, and I use a stick. So I've got a big rock that I've been asked to move. So here's the ground. Here's the big rock. Okay? I got to move it. I can't possibly move it if I just try to push it. So what I might do is maybe pick a smaller rock, put it here, and then I'll make it a bit higher just because then it becomes a little less confusing. I have a smaller rock there, and then I'm going to take a stick, and I'm going to go like so. Okay, so here's our fulcrum. Here is our resistance, and here is our effort. The sheer fact that the upper arm is as long as it is means I have to use less energy to move the rock than if I tried to move the rock myself. Okay, so I've utilized a lever to my advantage. So I've shortened the resistance arm and I've lengthened the effort arm. Therefore, it takes less effort to move the rock. Everybody follow me? Okay. You know, this is why, crowbars have long handles on them for popping stuff out, because that moment arm, or the effort arm, that I'm moving with my hand, it makes less work because it's so long. Okay. So, a seesaw balance scale scissors. Flexion and extension of the head on the C-spine is an example of a first-class lever. So saying yes is an example of a first-class lever. The articulation between the superior service of C1 and the condyles on either side of the foramen magnum, or the fulcrum, the anterior head is, and it can change, right? This is a lever that can change, because it depends on if I'm flexing, where's the effort, anteriorly or posteriorly? Anteriorly, right? So anterior muscles are providing the effort and the head comes down. What is the, what are those anterior muscles fighting against? The posterior head. If I'm trying to go into extension, my effort arm is where? Posteriorly, and my weight, my resistance is the anterior head. Does everybody follow that? All right. So when I say to you, you know, when we were talking about sort of moving limbs and so forth, we say that if a muscle is to affect movement at a joint, it has to overcome resistance. Resistance in the empty hand is the weight of whatever it is you're wanting to move against gravity, for example. Right? So you've got the weight of the limb that you want to move, you have to overcome the weight of the limb. If I throw a 25-pound dumbbell on there, I have to overcome the weight of the limb and the 25-pound dumbbell in order to affect movement. Everybody follow me? Okay. Where is the resistance in this example and where's the load? We did that. So we can see here, right, we've got our resistance here anteriorly for trying to move across. So our fulcrum is in the center, and we have the arms on either side, load and force. And as I showed you, it can go both directions. A second-class lever. Now, in this lever, the resistance lies between the axis and the effort. So in this case, our fulcrum is here on this end, our resistance is in the middle, and our force is here. So let's say we had some kind of rock or something here, and we wanted to load this up with some weight, we would have to move it here. What's an example of that? So you've got an axis anteriorly, you've got a load in the middle, a wheelbarrow. So a wheelbarrow is a second-class lever. You've got the wheel in the front, which is the fulcrum. You've got the big bin in the middle, which is the resistance. And then the effort are the two handles of the wheelbarrow. Think of how much you can carry in a wheelbarrow. Could you carry that in your bare hands? Not in your life, most cases, right? So it is an advantage, again, mechanism where you can carry more. So, the effort arm is always longer than the resistance arm in this type of lever. So, if we look at it, a good wheelbarrow should have fairly long extended handles out from the barrel to make it far easier for us to work. This type of lever magnifies the effects of the effort so that it takes less effort to move the resistance. A nutcracker is also a second-class lever. Does anybody even use nutcrackers anymore? I just use a hammer. Nutcracker, okay, right? A second-class lever in the body is a controversial topic among experts. Some feel that when the foot is being plantar flexed in a weight-bearing position, it is a second-class lever. The fulcrum point of the ground contact, effort is at the heel where the Achilles tendon attaches, and the force is the weight of the body. I won't ask any questions on that. Some think it's that. The next we can see here, here's our wheelbarrow. So we've got our fulcrum in the front, anteriorly here, load in the middle, and the effort is applied between, or at the very end outwardly. So we can see fulcrum, load, force. Third class lever. The effort lies between the axis, fulcrum, and the resistance. So here, instead of resistance being in the middle, our force is in the middle. So we have our axis, then our force, then our resistance. Axis is here, force is in the middle, and the resistance is at the end. And you can see it right here in an arm curl. Here's your axis. Biceps brachii is your force that's applied between the axis and the resistance. And then the hand is holding the dumbbell here, which is the resistance out in the hand. Everybody can see that? Okay. That is a third class lever. This results in the creation of greater effort to overcome a given resistance. A very small motion by the effort results in a large movement in the resistance. So this lever is for speed and range of motion at the expense of force. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Load and resistance can be either or. Okay. So when we look at a third class lever, pretty much every lever in the human body is third class because it's all about range of motion and speed. Okay. But remember, all three levers depend on the length of those arms. So, for example, I say this jokingly. I stand in a gym, and I've got long levers. So you can see my limbs are relatively long. So I'm said to have long levers. So I have long biceps to a long forearm. I put a 25-pound dumbbell in. Anybody here got short levers? Who might have short levers? Yeah, somewhat so, but you're still a bit long. You know the guy in the gym that's got, like, his forearms are about this long, right? You know what I mean? Okay. Well, that individual has short levers, right? So he's curling 45 pounds, and I'm curling 25 pounds. So because my lever is longer to my resistance compared to him, with my 25-pound dumbbells, I'm likely lifting more than he is with the short lever at 45 because his arm is shorter. Because the resistance is not as far out as mine. So I used to do math in this class. I don't do it anymore. But just understand that when we look at this arm, this lever, right, we've got the force between the axis and there, and the fulcrum here is here, the force is here, the resistance is here. The longer this gets, the harder this needs to work. Does that make sense? So if someone has a short forearm, then they are, in fact, actually doing less work. In fact, when you look at very many weightlifters and bodybuilders, a lot of them are short-levered. Arnold Schwarzenegger was a prime example of an individual who actually built muscle mass with long levers. Arnold, actually, if you read any of his books, he talks about his long levers and some of the challenges he had in terms of weight training to bodybuild because the levers were so long. The other thing is about short and long levers, it's very important. Long lever people have more injuries than short because of the forces that they're placing on the joints with the amount of work that they have to do when they're in fact actually doing things like, you know, throwing a baseball or doing whatever, okay? And that's the reason why we're talking about this, because our next set of slides is about strength training. So we have to consider this when we're strength training someone or understand why someone may not be able to provide the forces that you would think necessary. So the lever is for speed and range of motion at the expense of force, and this is why it's the most common type of lever found in the human body. Any lever balances when the product of the effort and the effort arm equals the product of the resistance and the resistance arm. So what are our numbers in muscle testing? Zero through, okay. Which is the one that says can't overcome gravity? It's two, correct? Right. So in a two, in a strength test or muscle test, they are balanced and cannot create the force to move. Okay, so this is why you strength test, because you're trying to determine if there's anything that's affecting the muscle to be able to overcome, in this case, just the resistance of the limb. If I put a weight in there, it's okay to, you know, be stuck in balance. But if someone has, you know, neurological dysfunction or injury or damage, and they're unable to move that limb at all, then that's denoting to you that there's a weakness, and you have to sort of discover why. Because fundamentally, we need to be able to overcome the weight of our own bodies in most cases to move and be around the range of motion that's required of us, right? So, any lever balances when the product of the effort and the effort arm equals the product of the resistance and the resistance arm. So in the case of someone who can't move the biceps, we have equalization. They only can create enough force to equal the weight of the arm and no more. Because to actually do this, I have to be greater than the weight of that forearm under gravity, right? Okay? This is the principle of levers. This allows to calculate the amount of effort needed to balance a known resistance by means of a known lever, or to calculate the point at which to place the fulcrum in order to balance a known resistance with a given effort. In other words, E times EA equals R times RA. So effort times effort arm equals resistance times resistance arm. The reason I put this up here is for only one reason, is that if you have someone who can't perform something, you might be able to alter the arms, the lever arms, resistance, short and long, or effort, short or long, so that they can overcome to do something. Does that make sense to everybody? And how do you do that? Well, if you are the therapist that's providing resistance, stand up for a sec. Okay. Just turn and face them. So I want to resist shoulder abduction. Okay. So then you're not going to be able to do this. Okay. You're going to pretend you're not able to do it. Okay. So by doing this, and I go, okay, that's not going to work. I might go to here, and all of a sudden she can, because I'm putting less. My arm is shorter. Therefore, this is not having to do as much work. In this case, deltoids is not having to do as much work because the arm is shorter. The longer out here I go, what's this arm going to be? This is the, remember, it's third class, right? Fulcrum, effort, resistance. So by shortening the resistance, she might be able to perform the task. So if someone were coming to me, for example, with, had shoulder surgery and they were ready to do exercises to strengthen deltoid, I might have her do resisted abduction with her dumbbells like this to begin with, and then maybe eventually get out to this. Yes, thanks. Exactly. Good. Quite good statement. Because your fulcrum is your feet, which means the resistance arm is far longer. And by going to your knees, I've shortened the resistance arm. Remember, the effort's in the middle. I've shortened the resistance arm, so it's less work for me to do. And in some cases, if someone's extremely weak, I have them do a lazy push-up. Do you know what that is? No. You can go like this. You just ask them to keep their hip in. You can go like this, right? You can also do the wall if you choose to, because then what you've done now, you've taken a lot of the resistance out. Because I'm lying prone, I have my whole body weight I have to deal with, right? When I'm standing against the wall, I have a lot less because gravity is not working quite as much, right? So therefore, I've lowered the resistance. Okay? This principle also shows the importance of lever arm lengths in determining the amount of effort to balance a given resistance. If the effort arm is lengthened, while the resistance times the resistant arm remains constant, the amount of effort required to balance must decrease. If the resistance arm increases, the effort must increase. So this results in a third class lever requiring more effort than the resistance they must balance or move. So we gave up something to go to a third-class lever in the body. There are first-class and second-class are more efficient levers as compared to third. But in first-class and second-class, if we applied that to the human body, our range of motion and the speed of motion would diminish immensely. So it was decided, evolutionarily, I guess, that by having a third-class lever, we'd have a greater range of motion and we could move through space faster, depending on what the limb is, at the expense of resistance. So this is why, you know, when anything detrimental to a muscle, it's very difficult for a patient because of the amount of tension that's created when you do the math. If you take the, you know, the amount of resistance times the arms and so forth, there's a calculation for it. We don't have to do it here, but you get the sense of it, right? When a lever has an effort arm longer than the movement arm in first or second class levers, it's said to favor force. Like I showed you, the longer stick to move a rock. Make that effort arm longer, works become easier, but speed and range are reduced, right? So the longer that arm gets, the slower the movement and the less it moves. Yeah, well, yeah, depending on what you're using, but you're right, yeah. A lever whose resistance arm is longer, whether a first-class or third-class lever, favors speed and distance. The golf swing lengthens the anatomical arm and therefore lengthens the resistance arm, which increases speed and range. So when you have an implement, it actually becomes one of the arms. Because it's an extension of the limb, it becomes the anatomical arm. Remember, greater range equals increased speed. So why all this for massage? Remedial exercise, interpreting assessment results, functional abilities evaluations, which we're going to talk about, understanding activities of daily living. I'm sure you've heard enough of ADLs the last few weeks to use that term a lot in class yet or in theory, ADLs? No, you haven't used it a lot? Yeah, we'll start next semester, I'll tell you that. Okay? Because the whole reason for all of this is to return somebody back to normal who's lost function. Like I, you know, I talked about last week, able to brush your hair, brush your teeth, right? Perform a task at work, okay? So you may get people who've injured themselves at work and they need to get back to being able to perform whatever task that is at work. You could be providing exercise prescription for that. Interpreting functional requirements, we talked a whole lot about that last week, you know, what do you do at work, how do you do it, those sorts of things, okay? So that's as deep as I'm getting into it. All the kids in the class are going, yay, because I can only imagine the calculations you guys used to have to do. I don't know why he keeps doing this. Good Lord. Oh, look at that, I had a meeting with my boss today. Oops. All right, so with that in mind, we're going to move to strength training. And everybody got my announcement yesterday, right? So I took all that three slides and made it into one. No, it's good to go. Did I not? Okay, I'll look it up. I'll see if I can find it. Okay. I thought I had. All right. So with levers and stuff in mind, one thing we have to think about here is strength training. So muscle performance refers to the capacity of a muscle to do work. So force time distance. So how much force needs to be created and how much does it have to move? Performance can be affected by morphological qualities of the muscle. So you know, what's the muscle like? Has it been damaged? Is it functioning properly? Neurological, how's the innervation to that muscle? Has it been damaged to the innervation of that muscle to function properly? Biochemical and biomechanical influences. So, you know, it takes fuel for a muscle to contract properly and lack of fuel. This is why, if you ever notice, what do you see professional sports people doing all the time now? Drinking, right? They're drinking things. They're drinking electrolytes, right? They're discovering now more and more that through many things that people do, even golfers, for heaven's sakes, you know, walking through an 18-hole tournament in a day, they still need to fuel up, whether that's with electrolyte drinks or bananas. You see bananas is a very, very common kind of fruit because of its high amount of potassium in it. It's providing fuel for it. So without fuel, muscles can be affected. Metabolic, cardiovascular, respiratory, cognitive, and emotional function can all affect the abilities of muscle to perform. Components of muscle performance are strength, power, and endurance. And we have to remember, resistance exercise is any form of active exercise in which dynamic or static muscle contraction is resisted by an outside force, whether that force is manually by you, the therapist, or a machine that you can, you know, think about any machine in a gym, right? That's either or, it doesn't matter. It's about against resistance. That's the point. So, strength. How do we define strength? It is the ability of a muscle to produce tension and a resultant force based on the demands placed on the muscle, right? Which is exactly what you do when you're doing muscle testing, correct? You are providing the force when you're testing a muscle. It is the greatest measurable force that can be exerted by a muscle or muscle group to overcome resistance during a single maximum effort. So anybody here from Health and Fitness Promotion? Anybody from that? Okay. So what we used to do was we do what's called a 1RM. So we would warm a patient up or an individual up, ask them to perform a movement as with as heavy a weight as they possibly could, just one time. And then we would take a percentage of that, what they could do one time, and train them at a lower percentage of that 1RM. Okay? And then you prescribe accordingly as far as that goes. So, but ultimately, strength is defined as, you know, how much can I do just one time with everything I've got? Sort of defines how strong you are. Functional strength, though, is what we're concerned with. It's the ability of the neuromuscular system to produce, reduce, or control forces, contemplated or imposed, during functional activities in a smooth, coordinated fashion. So I talked about that last week, right? You know, I might play catch with my patients. I may ask them to bring in the tool they use at work. Show me how you use it. What do you do? I've had patients in the past who worked at a Honda in Alliston. You know, they're in a pit all day doing this. Right? So why is their shoulder hurting them? Why is their neck sore? Right? Show me what you do. That's what's important. How do I get them stronger to be able to perform that task? More often than not, the reason why people get hurt at work is because they're not in shape to perform the task they're asked to do. And the main reason why they don't work out is they say, oh my God, after 8 hour a day, you want me to go to the gym and work out? You kidding me? I've been doing this all day and now you want me to work out? Yes. Right? When I took a course many years ago, we were given a challenge. We had to figure out how to create an exercise routine for a long haul trucker. Yeah. Because imagine how out of shape they are, sitting in a truck all day, every day, right? So how do we get them stronger, especially their backs, sitting all day, those sorts of things, right? So there are challenges out there, but that's what you're coming up against. So quite often you are having to talk to patients about the reason why you're getting injured is because what is being asked of you, that's your maximum strength. So if you're working at maximum strength, your percentage of injury goes up. So I want you to work at a percentage of strength, of your strength, when you go to work and perform your task all day. So I need to get you in the gym and get you stronger so you're only working at 60 or 50 or 70% of what your natural strength is to perform the task wherever you're doing. Does that make sense to everybody? I hope so, because that's really important to understand. You're basically, you get a sense of what the patient does, and as I said, the majority of patients who get injured are being asked to perform a task which is their maximum effort. You want to get your patient in shape to a point where what's being asked of them is only a percentage of what they're capable of doing, and injuries go down. Okay? Always keep that in mind. This is why, again, when you do a muscle test, you know, I might do a muscle test like I did with Sam, because she says this is what she's expected to do 100 times a day, and I can't even barely get her to do it once. No wonder there's a problem with her shoulder, right? I need to get it stronger so she can, and she's a professional flyer, whatever, right? It's important to understand that. Development of muscle strength is an integral component of most rehab or conditioning programs, all ages, all abilities. I've told you guys, right, about my old folks in the home. So I took a course years ago with a gerontologist out of London, and he was going on to talk about deconditioning. His claim was that the majority of individuals who are in long-term care is not because of sickness. It's because they're so deconditioned they can't function any longer. Right? They can't reach up in a cupboard and get a can anymore. Even just getting a 19-ounce can of beans is a struggle for them. And this is what happens. So with that in mind, I did a little bit of a anecdotal kind of bit of research. I took three ladies in long-term care. I used to go to long-term. When I worked in physio, we worked in long-term care once a week. I took three ladies. One was in a wheelchair, one was in a walker, and what was the other lady? She just functionally struggled getting up out of a chair and doing whatever. I brought in surgical bands and cans of beans, and within 6 weeks of training, the lady in the wheelchair was in a walker, the lady in the walker was walking, and the lady that was struggling was walking up and down stairs like crazy. So it does not matter how old someone is, they can still train. So the next time everybody's saying, Grandma, I'll do that for you. No, Grandma can do it for herself. that is the biggest benefit you can give grandma. Make her do it, because that's going to allow her to be independent for much, much longer in their life. So it's something to always keep in mind. Anybody can train, no matter what. Well, I do, you know how many times I went to long-term care, a vibrant individual will come into the long-term care facility, and due to the lack of stimulation, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, within 3 to 4 months, they're in a chair. Drools running down. It's brutal. Deconditioned, no stimulation in the mind, whatever. Terrifies me to end up in long-term care. Yeah. Right.
And at a certain age, if you're not getting rehab, you're not.
No. See it. Yeah. Failure to drive. Yeah.
I remember how to write like a paper about this, and it's literally because like often long-term care, like it's such a vast age group of like 60 to 100, and they give them all the same activity, expecting them all to like like it or like be fit for all the age groups, and like it's not.
Great. Do anything now. This is, you do have to modify. Don't get me wrong. This is why, you know, like I used to date a lady and she went into long-term care here and she did chair yoga, right? Because, you know, these individuals, one of the number one things that occurs from deconditioning in elderly people is balance. And balance is one of the big things you have to think about, right? You try to get some of these individuals to stand on one foot, they're falling over, right? They don't have the strength. And when they don't have the strength and this doesn't work, right, your ear doesn't work properly. So there are things to keep in mind. Power is related to the strength and speed of movement and is defined as work force time distance produced by a muscle per unit of time. Okay? This is the rate of performing work. So not only do I need to know the individual in the pit in Honda, the work they do, how fast, how many are they expected to do in a given shift. Now, the nice thing, Honda changed their rules a number of years ago. I believe if you're in the pits doing overhead work, I think you work for 30 minutes and get a 20-minute break. It's actually better because their employees are now getting injured less. So even though it sounds counterintuitive, it was actually they were making more profit by giving people 20 minutes off to give that upper neck and head a rest. Can be done over a brief period, such as lifting heavy box onto a high shelf, or repeated bursts of less intense muscle activity, like climbing a flight of stairs. Endurance, of course, we all have a sense of what that is. This is a muscle that contracts, lifts, or lowers a light load for many repetitions, or sustain a muscle contraction for an extended period of time. Beep, 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 beep. Who does this? Beep, beep, cashiers. How many times you go in the grocery store, what do they have on their wrist? A splint. It's repetitive, but guess what? They're not in shape to do that for an 8-hour day. You bring them into physio, give them strength, strengthen those forearm muscles, those shoulders, they're less likely to end up with a splint. Even something as simple and as light as just sliding someone over a glass. It's the accumulation in an 8-hour day. Right? So if you get them stronger, they're better prepared to deal with it. Fundamentally, these are generally low-intensity muscle contractions with a large number of repetitions and over a prolonged period of time. So again, the cashier who's sliding things across the glass, be quite interesting to do a bit of research and follow 8 or 10 or 12 of them and come up with a general average as to how often they're performing that task. I think it would probably shock the heck out of you how many times an individual would be required to do that in a shift. Quite often used in the early parts of rehab, so you know, lighter weights, longer periods of time, especially if you know they've had damage or injury where the muscle is very weak. We don't want to get in there and start pumping away at it, so we start low and work that way. So why or how does strength training work? For muscle performance to improve, a load that exceeds the metabolic capacity of the muscle is applied. The muscle must be challenged to perform at a greater level than that which it's accustomed to. You either increase intensity or you increase volume. If you don't challenge that muscle, it will not change. It won't get any stronger. It's got to be enough that it's more than the muscle is used to. And you have to remember in your head, It's about them, not you. So if, in fact, you have a patient and it's a 7-ounce dumbbell that they have to use to overcome, then that's where they're at. And then you work accordingly from there, right? Because we get stuck in our heads, you know, 5-pound dumbbell or whatever. In rehab medicine, sometimes those bands that they use are very, very light, but it's all they need to start having that overload principle. This always applied in the context of the underlying pathology, age of the patient, stage of tissue healing, fatigue, and overall abilities and goals of the patient. So again, you still need to overload, but you have to keep a lot of things in mind. What's overload for them, where they're at, what they're expected to do, and so forth. So the SED principle, specific adaptation and imposed demands. This is the framework of specificity, and it is a necessary foundation on which exercise programs should be built. So I talked about this last week to some degree. You got to do an assessment that looks at what the expectation is, breaking it down into what muscles work, what movements are happening, and so forth. And you create your exercise prescription specific to the requirement of whatever the patient needs. It's no different than sports, right? If I have a hockey player, I'm going to have exercise them a little differently than someone who's a baseball player, than someone who's a football player, someone who's a soccer player. There are similarities but differences simply because what is the specificity of that individual in terms of their requirements or their needs? Wolf's Law states, body systems adapt over time to the stresses placed on them. So there's a direct correlation to Wolf's Law and the overload principle. You must place stress on the tissue or it will not train and get better. So it has to be hard, whatever hard is for them. Right? It has to challenge. The adaptive effects of training are highly specific to the training method employed. Exercise incorporated in a program should mimic the anticipated function. So as you go through, you've already started taking case histories, right, in terms of health status, but you're also going to start taking assessments of, you know, what a patient does, what they don't do. What I really want to see you do is when a patient comes in and has a problem, it's through those activities of daily living and dysfunction. What do you do every day, Mrs. Jones? What can't you do every day? What would you like to do with treatment, right? And then you start building accordingly from there. And if after all that, it is glaringly obvious that they need to get stronger, then exercise them. That's our scope of practice, and you can still charge for that. Maybe it's not getting on a table all the time that they need. Maybe it's getting in the gym and getting stronger so that they're better able to function in their day-to-day lives. Please try to remember that and keep that in mind all the time. Reversibility principle. So these adaptive changes in response to resistance training are transient unless training-induced improvements are regularly used or the individual participates in a maintenance program. So this is the other problem that happens. Do you think patients do what you tell them to do forever and ever? No, thank God they don't, otherwise it'll all go broke. So they do what they do until they feel better, and then guess what happens? I'm better. And then they're back in the office, right? Oh, you doing your exercises, Brian? No. Right? So, you know, they need to understand that in some cases, like, so I've told you guys I have a bad back, right? I have a little sthesis, and I work out every day. I have to, because if I don't, I can't function. Now, working out changes every day for me, but I need to do aerobic work to warm up, and I need to do specific stretches, then I'm able to function in the day. If I take a Saturday off, which I do because you can't work 7 days a week, I'm a lot stiffer, and getting out of bed is quite a challenge for me, and getting warmed up and moving around and so forth. So this is what patients need to understand. You've got a problem, Mrs. Jones. It's kind of there for life, so this is what you need to do in order to manage it and deal with day-to-day life and so on and so forth, okay? And it can get weird. Okay, in terms of specificity. And this is a true story. I don't know if I should stop recording here or not. I had a patient come in one day, a gentleman, low back pain. Very debilitating, could barely function. In our conversation, sir, what would you like to be able to do? Well, there's a couple things I'd like to be able to do. I want to be able to drive my car for a long period of time. I want to be able to garden in the garden, and I want to be able to make love to my wife. And that was important to him. And that's something that you have to understand. That was important to him to be able to do that. In fact, we actually had a book that we kept on the shelf that said, How to Have Sex with a Bad Back. And we would hand it out to patients and would speak to their needs. This is something you have to get really comfortable with, because sometimes what's important to them, you would be quite shocked at. And it may not be just making love. It could be many other things that they want to be able to do. And you have to keep that in mind, right? In this case, the gentleman had disc herniation with, you know, significant pain down the leg and so forth. And the position for him was just too much to overcome, and he wasn't able to do what he enjoyed doing. So, or he and his wife enjoyed doing. So you've got to keep that in mind in terms of specificity. Recovery, of course, you have to find time for recovery, right? And, you know, people who work 7 days a week, work out 7 days a week every day for a year, yeah, potential for injury is bad. You also need time to be able to rebuild. So the whole point of weight training, for example, is you've got to give periods of time where the body has time to recover from the stress you've placed on it and then keep moving forward. So adequate time for recovery must be built into every resistance exercise program. The body must be given time to restore itself to a state that existed prior to the exhausted state. Now, this even includes during the exercise period. So everybody knows what sets are and repetitions, right? So repetitions, I might do it 8 times, and then I'm going to take a recover period until I do the next set. I've got to give my muscles time to recover. 90 to 95% of pre-exercise capacity usually takes 3 to 4 minutes, with the greatest proportion of recovery during the first minute. My traditional workout is I do my repetitions, I wait 60 seconds, I do my repetitions again. It used to drive me out of my mind to see individuals in the gym, and they would be chest day, and they'd be in there for 3 friggin' hours. They say an appropriate workout, including endurance, should be no more than 90 minutes. That's your stretches, your cardio, and your resistance training. So you've got to give yourself time. Adaptations. So what happens? Well, neurally, the initial rapid gain of strength is attributed to neural responses. So anybody who's, you know, started working out, back to working out after an extended period of time, you start gaining strength pretty quickly. Like, wow, you know, that 5-pound dumbbell is like feeling pretty light pretty quick. That's neural. That has to do with the conversation between the nervous system and the muscle. It's not strength gains. It's actually neural efficiency. It's also related to motor learning and improved coordination and increased recruitment in the number of motor units fired. We're going to talk a little bit about that later. Skeletal system, of course, hypertrophy, which means the size of the muscle grows. And I have a question for the guys and gals here. Came out of Kin recently. What are they saying about hyperplasia? Is it still kind of, we're not sure, or are they discovering that you actually are getting increase in numbers of muscle cells? Yeah, see, everybody thinks you get increased muscle cells, but everything up until now, it still is, maybe if you're doing the crazy, crazy stuff, like the strongest men sort of things, but generally you don't gain any more muscle cells. All you do is make them bigger. Connective tissue, of course, the tendons, the ligaments, the coverings, they all get thicker, they get stronger. And as a result of that, then the skeletal system, the bones, they get stronger. Hence the reason why we want that kind of training for people with osteoporosis, because it demands that the bones get more dense, which is what we want in that pathology. Examination and evaluation. So before we even set up an exercise prescription, we need to do a comprehensive examination and evaluation, and a thorough exam should be done. So that should include health history, interview, an orthopedic assessment, and then that interview, of course, is, you know, what do you do in your life? What can't you do? What do you want to be able to do? And so forth. And then reevaluate periodically. This is something that is not part of our scope, but something I really want you to consider when you're in this, and it has to do with everything I've been talking about digging in and finding out what the patient is expected to do. It is called a functional abilities evaluation. Has anybody heard of this before? So this is an evaluation that, yes.
Is that like an activity analysis?
Yeah, there is FAE and there's also FAC. FAC, FAE, FAC. So there's a couple of different names for it. But ultimately, this is an evaluation that can be done physically or through an interview that helps identify the movements that are required and the weights or resistance during those movements. So, for example, we used to have a shelf in the physio office I worked in, because I used to have to do FAEs all the time for WSIV. So I had a milk carton. And with the interview with the patient, I'd say, well, how much do you think you have to lift in a day? All those boxes are 24 pounds. Okay. So I take a milk carton and put 24 pounds in it. And then I'd say, okay, do you lift floor to knee? Do you lift floor to waist, floor to chest, floor to shoulder, above head? Yeah, right? Knee to waist, knee to chest, and so forth. So what do you do? So then what I would do is they would say, well, I do this and I do that. Okay. So let's put 24 pounds in. Can you do it one time? No, I can't. Not today. Okay, so we take the weight down and we figure it out. So what I'm doing is the job demands this, floor to waist, waist to above head. So I put weights in the milk carton and ask the patient to do it. And if they can't, I know where they need to get to because they told me the job says 22 pounds here and 15 pounds there. Okay, so you can only do a 10 pounds here and 5 pounds there. So now we've got something to work with, right? So what's required for me to go from floor to waist? Joint movements, muscle contractions, eccentric, concentric, so on and so forth, right? That builds your plan. Okay, we need to get this stronger. We need to get that longer. You following me, right? Okay, that's what this is all about. That's what strength training, aerobic, and all kind of stuff is all about. Now, that's just for a work one, right? So I'm talking about boxes on shelves. But it could be throwing a baseball, hitting a slap shot, right? If you've ever been in a good old-fashioned physio, they have bolts on the walls. Have you ever seen that? So they have little holes. They put bolts in it. Got a big steering wheel, right? They may have to steer something, turn it, twist it. All that's doing is giving better understanding of what's required functionally for the patient in their day-to-day life, which is home or work or play. It makes no difference, right? So that's what we're trying to build here. Twisting, gripping, turning, etc. There are lots of courses out there. There's great books out there you might want to consider after you graduate. This really isn't part of our curriculum per se, but I like to introduce it to give you something to think about when you're trying to build this prescription that's has the specificity that's required and meets the needs of the patient, because ultimately that's what we're after, right? Trying to meet the needs of the patient. Open chain and closed chain. Open chain applies to complete unrestricted movement in space of a peripheral segment of the body, such as waving your hand or leg. Closed chain movements, the peripheral segments meet with considerable resistance, so remains fixed with the resultant proximal segment moving over the distal. So, in open chain, the hand or foot is free to move in space. The limb movement only occurs distal to the moving joint, and a muscle activation occurs in the muscle that crosses that joint. Arm curl is open chain. Okay, my hand's moving free. Throwing a baseball is open chain. Kicking a soccer ball is open chain. So you're determining, again, is it an open chain or closed chain? Closed chain, the motions in which the body moves on a distal segment is fixed or stabilized on a support surface. Movement at one joint causes simultaneous motions at distal as well as proximal joints in a relatively predictable manner. So, push-ups. I'm fixed, and I'm moving the body with my hands fixed. Another one is a squat. My feet are fixed. I'm moving the core. So these are known as closed-chained exercises. Get my drift? Okay? Pun intended. Determinants. The following need to be considered when designing a resistance exercise program. And this is the FIT principle. Frequency, how often do they do it? Intensity, how intense does it need to be, which can relate to how much weight and so forth. How long do they do it for, and what type? Eccentric, concentric, isometric, isotonic. Okay, yes.
Just in reference back to the open and closed.
Yeah.
Could you say that anything that's free weight is open and...
No, you could do squats with a free weight and still be closed. Because you're loading it in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know kettlebells, right? So you can put a kettlebell in and and do a squat, it's still considered closed because this isn't doing anything. Okay, you're keeping it in, and it's like, yes, yeah. Golf is open chain. Okay. Yep. Bowling. I haven't bowled in years. Preparation. So select and prescribe the forms of resistance exercise that are appropriate and expected to be effective. If implementing mechanical resistance exercise, determine what equipment is needed and available. And that, again, is part of your interview. Do you have a membership at a gym? Yes. What kind of equipment do they have there? Can I come out and have a look? And then set it up accordingly as far as that goes. Maybe they don't have exercise equipment. So now you got to get creative. Exercise tubing, cans of beans, anything. Could be lots of different things you have them do, right? Because you have to consider maybe financially they can't afford a gym membership. So how are you going to get them to do what you want them to do, right? Body weight. Good heavens. You know, that's the one thing that everybody forgets about. Push-ups, sit-ups, chin-ups. You can get pretty strong doing all those. I can still maybe do 2 chin-ups. Never really weak upper body. Squats as well, absolutely. Up and down stairs, right? Get a lot of work out there. So there's lots of alternatives. Review the anticipated goals and expected functional outcomes. Explain the exercise plan and procedures, and of course, get consent. You probably heard that exhaustively this semester. Yes. Demonstrate each exercise and the desired movement pattern. So you're going to be expected to do this in your oral practical in a couple semesters. So one of the things you'll have to do is give an exercise prescription to a patient. And one of the marks you'll have to achieve is to demonstrate it to the patients. So when you have an exercise you wish them to do, you, the therapist, will always demonstrate to them and then have them demonstrate it to you, and you make the alterations accordingly to ensure that the exercise they're doing is done appropriately and safely. Kind of makes sense, right, if you think about it?
Yeah.
Right? And then they'll come back 2 weeks later and they'll say, oh, that exercise isn't working. And no, it's not working. I say, okay, show it to me. And they do some convoluted, weird kind of thing, and you go, that's not what I showed you. Yes, you did. No, I didn't, right? So it's one of those challenges you always have with patients. So what do you consider? Alignment. So you need proper alignment by considering the fiber orientation, the line of pull of the exercise, and the action desired to be strengthened. Again, similar to muscle testing because you're trying to isolate muscles, right? Again, in the gym, a lot of times, what you see is exercises in the gym are for larger groups, but from a rehab perspective, you're always trying to isolate down to a specific muscle to perform tasks, right? It's a bit different. Stabilization, so refers to holding down a body segment or holding the body steady. It is imperative to maintain appropriate alignment, ensure correct muscle action, and ensure that the movement pattern is appropriate. I mean, how many times do you see this in the gym? They got the heavy weight, they're doing the arm curl, and they're doing this. Right? Okay. You're going to hurt yourself. Oh, my favorite is seated rowing. Oh, my goodness. Does anybody still here do the seated row where you come all the way forward so your chest is on your knees and you come back up and then finish the row like that? You might as well take your disc and knock it out and get rid of it. External stabilization. So you may be the therapist or another piece of equipment such as belts and straps. You know, if someone has weak core and you're trying to get the legs strengthened, you're thinking of a squat, I wouldn't go to a squat yet until you had more stabilization in the core. Maybe do seated presses, right? You know, the leg presses that you sit in, right? You're more stabilized. That way it's safer for the patient to do it rather than getting on a rack and, again, blowing your back out. Internal stabilization, this is an isometric contraction of an adjacent muscle group that does not impact the desired moment. So what do fitness instructors always tell you to do when you go to perform certain exercises? Tighten your core, right? Bit of a tilt, pelvic tilt, or the glutes or whatever, then perform the task. Same idea. Intensity, of course, the amount of external resistance imposed on the contracting muscle during each repetition, remembering that overload principle. Submaximal versus maximal. Again, that's determined on the goals and expected functional outcomes of the program. Also, the cause and extent of muscle performance deficits and the stage of healing. So where are they at? Yeah, they might need to get to 50 pounds, but maybe because of the injury or so forth, you know, we're not going to get to 50 pounds for a while. Patient's age, general health and fitness level. You know, different ages, of course, have different training abilities and so forth. So those all have to be kept in mind. Volume, the number of repetitions and sets of a particular exercise during a single exercise session multiplied by the intensity. The higher the intensity or resistance, the lower number of reps. So the closer I get to my max, the less number of repetitions I do. The farther away from my max, the more I can do. So if I'm really up close to like 85% of my max, maybe I'm only doing it 4 times. If I'm quite a bit down, I might do it 8 to 12 times. Again, it all depends on what the patient's required to have for whatever task they're performing. So remember, a repetition is the number of times a particular movement is performed consecutively, and sets are the number of consecutive repetitions grouped together, and that's a set. And again, there's always a rest for recovery between sets. All right? Is that pretty much review? Everybody kind of works out to some degree now, and they have a sense of it. Of course, you want them to warm up. That's important, you know, some like cardio or something to get those. I used to do a thing with patients, again, I used to do lifestyle stuff or training. I would take our double bubble, and I'd put it in a glass of ice water. And I'd pull it out, and I'd go to bend it, and what was it going to do? Snaps. Then I'd take the bubble gum, and I'd chew it in my mouth for 2 or 3 minutes, and pull it out. Is it going to snap? No, it bends and twists and turns. Think of muscles exactly the same way. Bring blood to the area, to muscles. Heat it up, that connective tissue in the muscle itself gets much more pliable, which decreases the probability of injury when they're working it. Replacement is of the resistance is at the distal end of the segment. Distal placement, of course, generates the greatest amount of external torque with the least amount of manual or mechanical resistance. It's exactly what I did with Sam. I provided the resistance. I went out far, which is going to be far harder for her to do, as I get more proximal, again, utilizing those levers when we think about it. We can be applied across an intermediate joint if the joint is stable and pain-free. So if we're going to go 2 joints out, so if this joint is the problem and we're going to cross another joint to get to the resistance, we want to make sure that other joint is stable enough to deal with the resistance being out here. Does that make sense? Yes, yes. Generally, that's what you do, right? And again, if doing abduction, if the elbow's not good, I'm not going to give the patient the hand to do it as far as that goes. Revise the placement if resistance of pressure from the load is uncomfortable for the patient. So if it hurts, of course, then we don't want to do that. Direction, so we want to apply it in the direction directly opposite to the desired motion. When you did muscle testing, what you are doing is you're aligning the fibers. That's how you isolate, right? So I'm trying to get the limb or the part in alignment with the muscle fibers themselves. So wherever that muscle line runs to, the fibers run to from attachment to attachment, I try and align that up in a straight line so that muscle gets worked. Same thing needs to happen with exercise, right? So if I'm going to perform a resistance exercise, I want to line that limb up so that muscle's working within the linear line of its fibers. Stabilization, I think we've already talked about that enough. Again, we just don't want all that extra stuff. Sometimes what I try to do, depending on the patient, I might give them very low weights and make them do the exercise with their feet right together. Why would I do that? Say they're doing an arm curl. Stabilization would suggest I want to be here. Feet shoulder width apart, doing it. Why might I occasionally take the weight down and make them put their feet together to do it? Which is putting... Right, makes the core work more for balance. But I wouldn't do the same weight that they would do here as if they were doing it here. But again, depends on the prescription and what the patient needs and where they're at. Number of repetition sets and intervals. Of course, we use 8 to 12 repetitions against a moderate exercise load. We are after muscular fatigue and adaptive gains. So you give them a weight if they can do it 8 to 12 times. If they can't do it 8 times, you take the weight down. And they do that weight until they can get to 12. When they get to 12, then you give them more weight. And start at 8, then work to 12. When they get to 12, you up the weight again. That's how you implement and slowly increase their ability to meet Wolf's Law, right, having to do that overload principle. Verbal or written instructions. The KISS theory. I've had patients come with 5 pages of exercises. You know, has them like a pretzel trying to do something they can't figure out. They're not an expert like you are. keep the movements and the exercises simple for them so they're easier to remember, they're more likely to do them. Cool down, of course, you want to cool down with rhythmic unresisted movements, and general stretching is also appropriate for it. The one thing yes. Any of them. Probably Kisner-Kolbe. Stay with these for now. Stay with these for now. You are getting a remedial exercise course in semester 3. You guys are getting a new course that's never existed before. So.
Okay, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know the origin and insertion of the muscle? Exactly. Here's what you did in lab. It's going to get a little more complicated next semester when we're doing appendicular.
But the thing is, like, in lab we did it, and I want to go back and review it somewhere where, like, read more.
Kisner-Kolbe has a bit in it, so if you're doing core such as the erectors or the abs, some great stuff in Kisner-Kolbe in terms of how to do it appropriately as far as that goes. Kisner-Kolbe does have some of it in there, and it'll get used much more exhaustively when you do this REMEX course in semester 3. Okay? Valsalva maneuver. So what to avoid? So Valsalva maneuver. Does anybody know what it is? Okay. The pure definition is an expiratory effort against a closed glottis. Not breathing. Right, I'm closing my glottis, I'm increasing pressure. So you've probably all done it when you've got something really heavy, you're like, right? Valsalva maneuver can kill you, actually. If you have something going on in your heart and you do it, you increase pressure so much in here, you can end up giving yourself an MI. So the most important thing is to always remind your patient to breathe, right? So when do you breathe? If I'm doing a concentric exercise, I generally exhale concentrically, inhale eccentrically, contract, right? And I know it sounds funny, you know, if you're not used to gyms and you hear people going, or it's actually beneficial, believe it or not, because it gets that pressure out. What's that? The only time I can't stand it is in tennis. Drives me bonkers during tennis. The other thing is substitute motions. You're trying to isolate a specific muscle to do a task. The body always wants to bring in substitute muscles to perform the task. So you have to work with the patient for them not to use those substitute muscles and just the muscle that you're trying to isolate to strengthen. Does that make sense to everybody? All right, so you got to keep an eye out for that. Delayed onset of muscle soreness. Everybody's heard of DOMS? Yes? No? Maybe? How many people here lift weights the first time and the next day you can't even touch that muscle? It hurts so bad. That is what this is. After any form of muscular overexertion, DOMS is noticeable in the muscle belly or the musculocutaneous junction. It starts to develop anywhere between 12 to 24 hours after cessation of exercise. High-intensity eccentric muscle contractions cause the most severe DOMS, so eccentrically. Can last from 10 to 14 days. I have never had DOMS for 14 days. Anybody here ever had them for 14 days? Yeah, and I love them. I love having DOMS. I miss it. I love it. I pound at them. I think it's great, right? Concurrent research suggests that DOMS is linked to some form of contraction-induced mechanical disruption, which would be a microtrauma, of those muscle fibers and or connective tissue. And what happens is you get inflammation because of that damage and edema in the tissue, and that's what it's about. To avoid, it is suggested that the patient just progress through and continue with a lighter amount. And guess what? Massage doesn't help it. Contrary to popular belief. Pain during testing prior or during the exercise. Reduce resistance. If the pain continues, stop. We don't do it if there's inflammation in the area. Acute inflammation in a joint also is an SCI, so if you're crossing a joint that's got like arthritic, like RA or something, we don't do it. Severe cardiopulmonary disease, so in their case history, if they've recently had a heart attack or they have heart disease, you do not do any resistance exercise until clearance is given by their physician or specialist, okay? We wait until then. Severe cardiopulmonary and respiratory diseases is resistance, sorry. After an MI or a bypass procedure, resistance training should be postponed for at least 5 weeks, and you do not do exercise resistance exercises with that patient until, again, they are cleared. Take a break. See you guys between 1:45 and 10:02. We need to do this first. So I've sort of said it a couple of times. Muscles, we had to learn that muscles had innervations. And, we would say that this muscle is innervated by C3, C4, C5, or whatever it may be. I want to talk a little bit about both efferent and afferent nervous system. In other words, the nervous system that sends messages to muscles, and then the nervous system that sends messages to the nervous system. So the first one we're going to go through are the efferent nerves, and these are the nerves that go out to the specific muscles. So what does it mean when we say that a muscle is innervated by a certain nerve? So this is a discussion of the nerve supply to varying muscles. It's very rare that there's variations in nerve supply of muscles. So quite often you'll see some minor variations, but fundamentally, if you can imagine, anatomists did take, they would start right at the spinal cord, and they would dissect and follow a nerve all the way out to all its branches of what muscles it actually touched or innervated. It's very, the skeletal muscle is under conscious control. In other words, we initiate the movement and to work. Therefore, there must be some way for the message to go from the brain to the specific muscles needed to perform the job required. So in some cases, that comes all the way up from the very top of the brain, called a motor neuron or a motor nerve cell. And then we have a motor nerve cell, also known as an upper motor neuron, that travels through the midbrain, the pons, the medulla, and at the medulla it crosses over to the other side and then travels down the spinal cord till it gets to a point where it exits out the intervertebral foramen and off it goes to go to the specific muscle that it's associated with. So nerves pass into and out of the spinal column, and these are called spinal nerves, and there are 31 pair. Nerves that innervate the muscle are called motor nerves, right? Causes movement. Spinal nerves from C1 to C7 exit superior to their corresponding vertebra. So C1 exits above C1, C2 exits above C2, C3 exits above C3, C4 exits above C5, C6 exits above C6, C7 exits above C8, C7 exits above C7, and C8 exits above T1, because is there a C8? No. So, spinal nerves from C1 to C7 exit superior to the corresponding vertebra. C8 exits between C7 and T1, and from there on, T1 to L5, the spinal, the nerves exit inferior to the corresponding vertebra. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is above. 8 is a transition between C7 and C8, or C7 and T1. And then below T1 is the nerve, T1 nerve, T2 nerve is below and below. So above 1 through 7 of C-spine, and then below T1 to L. Okay? So L5. So we can see it here. Coming all the way down, this is the central nervous system here that we can see. We have the brain, and then we have all these branches. And wherever you see all of these sort of heading out, they are exiting out of specific intervertebral foramen. The C-spine, they're exiting above the vertebra. As I said, C7, T1 in between those two. And then forever T1 through, they're exiting below their vertebra. Okay? And, of course, they head off to wherever they're going, and because they're motor, they're leaving the spinal column and heading out to the particular muscles. And this is just reminding you of the intervertebral foramen that we talked about previously, and that's where they exit out of. Spinal nerves of the C-spine innervate the arm, diaphragm, muscles of the neck. and extrinsic muscles of the back, such as levator scapulae and rhomboids. The spinal nerves of the T-spine innervate structures such as pectoralis major, intercostal muscles, serratus anterior and posterior. The spinal nerves of the lumbar spine innervate such structures as muscles of the abdominal wall, muscles related to the reproductive structures, muscles related to the hip joint and parts of the leg. It does continue through into the sacrum here. So, you know, we talked about their names of them. They then are named according to their sacral or coccygeal exits as well. So we do have neurons that exit out of the sacrum and in around the coccyx. The spinal nerves of the sacrum innervate such structures as the anal region, some pelvic muscles, and muscles of the lower leg. Okay? When spinal nerves enter the body, they're given specific names according to the regions they may pass through, their length or structures they are associated with or close to. For example, quadratus femoris is the femoral nerve L2, L3, L4, which means it's traveling through the femoral area. You will note that in the previous, two of the nerves are bolded, and of course, as we know from previous, they are the major innervators of the muscle. So if some damage is done to L2, you might have some minor weakness of the muscles that are innervated by that nerve, right? But the ones in black that are bolded, if there's damage done to them, then you're going to have significant changes in the strength or function of a muscle because they're the major innervators of that muscle. If both of L4 and L3 are damaged, you're going to maybe even have a flaccid or paralyzed muscle that can't function much at all. If a major innervator is destroyed, the muscle is unable to contract fully, and if all levels are disrupted, such as in a spinal cord injury, the muscle cannot function at all. So one of the things, just again, little seed in the back pocket, when you're doing muscle testing and you have that grade of 0 to 5, when you're seeing 0, 1, and 2, now you have to consider, is there something going on at the spinal cord, at the innervation level, that's causing this muscle to be weak? It's just one of those questions that will arise while you're doing your muscle testing. So we can see here, we've got the exiting out here from the, again, below, right? Exiting out the motor neurons down to innervate any of the muscles here. We have one of the largest nerve, well, it is the largest nerve in the body outside the spinal cord. It is called the sciatic nerve. We'll be spending a little more time on that when we're doing next semester. And in semester 3, you do have a complete neuroanatomy course that you're going to get into this a lot more. Okay, so that's the motor neurons. Now, the ones that are coming from the muscles to the spinal nervous system. The first is called a muscle spindle. This is a proprioceptor. So this allows us to know where our head and limbs are and how they're moving, even if we're not looking at them, of any particular muscle. So our ability to reach out and not even see what's going on is because of these proprioceptors, or letting the brain know where my hand is in that space at any given time. There is a neurological test, for example, if they think someone's got an issue with proprioception. You have to put your hands out like this, close your eyes, and touch the tip of your nose. Someone who has a neurological condition could go like this, because they haven't, the conversation of where the hand is in space isn't speaking well to the brain. They participate in something called the stretch reflex, the muscle spindle. Muscle spindles also help set the overall muscle tone, which is controlled by the brain. So again, someone who's alive, you know, there's a bit of tone in the muscle. Someone who is dead, we use the term dead weight, because there is no brain function, all the muscles in the body have no tone and become flaccid. And it's perceived as being heavier because there's no tone. We do find muscle spindles interspersed among skeletal muscle fibers, and it looks like this. So it's a specialized area within skeletal muscle. And these afferents, remember, afferent is from the muscle to the spinal cord or the central nervous system. And efferent is from the central nervous system to the structure. So this is embedded between muscle fibers throughout any skeletal muscle. It's called the muscle spindle. They monitor changes in the length of skeletal muscles and participate in the stretch reflex. How many people here either have stretched themselves or are stretching someone else? And you see the twitch of muscle when you go too far into the stretch. Yes? You ever notice that? Get that little bit of stretch? Okay. When a muscle is stretched too far, it stimulates the muscle spindle. When the muscle spindle is overstimulated, it causes contraction of that muscle to say, don't go any farther, and it's trying to contract back because it's saying it's gone too far. Yeah. No, that's a whole other different thing. You'll take that in neuroanatomy and the pain lectures. That's there's a whole lot more involved in it than that. So ultimately, then, the muscle spindle is involved in when the muscle gets long, it stimulates the muscle it's embedded in to contract to prevent it from going any longer. Does that make sense? When the muscle spindle is stimulated, it sends a muscle, it sends a message that will result in the muscle you're trying to stretch to contract. That's its mechanism. Yes? Okay. It consists of several slowly adapting sensory nerve endings that wrap around 3 to 10 specialized muscle fibers. And because they're within a capsule within the muscle, they're called intrafusal fibers. So we have nerve endings. So remember, we are talking a nerve that is sending messages back to the central nervous system, okay? These nerve endings wrap around 3 to 10 specialized muscle fibers within the muscle spindle that are called intrafusal fibers. Let's go to this picture here. These cells right here, they are muscle cells, but because they're encapsulated within the muscle, these light pinky ones here are your extrafusal muscle fibers. You can see it here as well. So you can see the whole belly here, and then we've got this little encapsulated proprioceptor here, the muscle spindle. So we've got nerves that wrap around these intrafusal fibers. These intrafusal fibers are surrounded by a connective tissue capsule, and this capsule is anchored into the endomysium and perimysium of the muscle. So it utilizes connective tissue to anchor itself within the connective tissue of the muscle. So you have a capsule that's anchored in association with the connective tissues of the muscle itself. And then within the capsule are these 3 to 10 specialized muscle fibers, intrafusal fibers, that have nerve endings wrapped around them. Yes, no, maybe? The muscle that produce finely controlled movements have many spindles in them. So, you know, whenever we have like our hands or our eyes, there's lots of muscle spindles in the muscles that control those structures because there needs to be a significant amount of proprioception as to where they are in space and all the various movements that eyes can do just to give the brain kind of where everything is. Coarser but more forceful muscles such as your quads and hamstrings have very few. So, within this capsule, you have motor neurons. So we have sensory neurons that wrap around the fibers that go back to the nervous system. But we also have nerve endings that come into the spindle that are motor. So we find motor neurons, and these are known as gamma motor neurons. And these gamma motor neurons terminate near both ends of the intrafusal fibers and adjust the tension in a muscle spindle to variations in length of the muscle. So depending on what's happening, here is our afferent sensory fiber, nerve endings here. So you can see how they're wrapped around the intrafusal fibers. And then down here at the very end, we have motor neurons that can stimulate these intrafusal fibers. And we need some tension in the fibers within the muscle spindle to maintain tone in a muscle. So we say the motor neurons terminate in both ends of the intrafusal fibers and they adjust the tension in the muscle spindle. So for example, in a biceps curl, so when we're curling, the gamma motor neurons stimulate the ends of the intrafusal fibers to contract slightly. So what's happening when I do to the regular muscles, the regular fibers of a muscle, what's happening to the length of those muscles when I'm doing an arm curl? Right. So therefore, that muscle spindle, intrafusal fibers, they would shorten as well. The problem is we don't want them to shorten. We want them to maintain tension. So while the rest of the muscle is shortening in the contraction, right, the gamma motor neurons, because remember, the spindle is a proprioceptor, it's sending a message, I'm getting short. I'm getting short. So then the message goes back to the spinal cord, and a direct message comes right back where the gamma motor neurons, the efferent ones, say to the intrafusal fibers, please contract to stay tense. This helps maintain sensitivity to the stretch of the muscle. So it provides that small contraction through those gamma motor neurons provides a better proprioception of what's happening when the proprioceptor is sending a message to the brain. Surrounding the spindle are normal skeletal muscle fibers, and they are known as extrafusal muscle fibers, and they're supplied by large diameter alpha motor neurons, which are very fast. So we have gamma motor neurons that penetrate through the capsule and affect the intrafusal muscles within the capsule of the muscle spindle. And of course, the muscle spindle sits inside the muscle belly. All the other fibers of the muscle that are not the muscle spindle, they're innervated by alpha motor neurons, which of course cause the muscle to contract. So the fact that I went like this, right? The fact that I just decided to do that, my alpha motor neurons have been stimulated because my brain said, I want to do this. So the message has gone down, and through these alpha motor neurons, my biceps contracts. Yes? Okay. At the same time, at the spinal cord, the gammas are also sending a message to the intrafusal fibers to contract as well, to maintain tension. Impulses in the muscle spindle sensory nerves enter into the spinal cord and brainstem and activate the alpha motor neurons, which causes the muscle to contract to relieve the stretch. Okay, so what's happening is, when you're stretching a muscle, you are lengthening the intrafusal fibers. The intrafusal fibers are sending a message to the spinal cord that they're getting elongated. At a certain point of elongation, the message from the intrafusal fibers via the afferent nerves is now going to stimulate a movement across the spinal cord to stimulate the gamma motor neurons to contract, to prevent the muscle from getting any longer. I lost you all, didn't I? Okay. Here's your muscle spindle, right? Right here in the muscle. If I try to stretch this muscle out, these fibers are going to send a message to the spinal cord that it's getting long in the stretch. If the stretch gets too far, the message from the spindle will stimulate a message to travel across the spinal cord to the gamma motor neurons, which will send a message for the whole muscle itself to contract to prevent the muscle from getting too long. Does that make more sense? Okay? Hence why if you stretch someone too far, you get those little twitches that are going on in there. You've gone too far. You need to back off. So as a general rule, when you're passively stretching someone, if it gets to that where that muscle's twitching, back that stretch off. Okay? Yeah? No, the whole muscle is doing it. The muscle spindle has sent a message, though, to say, I'm going too far, contract, contract, contract. And then the muscle belly itself contracts. So you've got afferent fibers in blue that are sending a sensory message back. And then again, it gets too far, you have efferent message going back for the muscle to contract. Okay. The next one is the Golgi tendon organ. So the muscle spindle ultimately is, it protects the muscle from damage by causing a contraction. Okay? So the longer it gets, the more it stimulates a muscle to possibly contract to prevent it from getting any longer. Does everybody follow that part of it? Okay. Golgi tendon organ. they're located in the musculotendinous junction. So right where kind of muscle tissue is ending and tendons beginning, right at that point of that transition. They're slowly adapting receptors, and this organ protects the muscle and tendons from excessive tension. So the muscle spindle is measuring length, and the Golgi tendon organ is measuring tension. It consists of a thin capsule of connective tissue that encloses a few bundles of collagen fibers. So in the muscle spindle, we had a few fibers of muscle fibers, intrafusal. The Golgi tendon organ, it involves a few fibers of tendon, of connective tissue, okay? Collagen. One or more sensory fibers penetrate the capsule and entwine among and around the collagen fibers of the tendon. When the tendon gets increased tension, as occurs in a stretch, this organ sends a message to the central nervous system for the muscle to relax. So the muscle spindle stimulates for contraction, and the Golgi tendon organ stimulates for the muscle to relax. This is why you've learned GTO. Well, that's what you're doing. You're trying to stimulate the Golgi tendon organ to send a message to relax the muscle, then it should be easier to elongate. So we can see it here. You've got these buried kind of within the fibers here. And again, the Golgi tendon organ, it sends a message via the spinal cord, which crosses the spinal cord, and a message gets sent to relax or inhibit contraction. Inhibition is relaxation. When a muscle relaxes, it's being inhibited from being stimulated by the central nervous system to contract. Does everybody understand that? That's okay. When the Golgi tendon organ sends a message for the muscle to the central nervous system that there's increasing tension, the central nervous system sends an inhibitory message to the muscle, which relaxes it. Stimulation equals contraction. Inhibition equals relaxation. So where the spindle causes a signal to come to the muscle to contract, the Golgi tendon organ sets up the central nervous system to prevent a signal from getting to the muscle, which it then therefore relaxes. Okay? All right. Now, the other thing that occurs here, I don't know if I have it here in the picture or not. I probably don't. All right. We've already said this before. If I want my biceps to contract, what has to happen to triceps? Right. That is known as reciprocal inhibition. So for my triceps to contract, my biceps have to be inhibited so they doesn't contract, which allows that tricep to elongate, right? Okay. So that's called reciprocal inhibition. Did you know that when I ask my bicep on the right to contract, my bicep on the left relaxes? Again, you get a cross message at the spinal cord as well. What your key things are for you guys, muscle spindle equals contraction when it gets too long. Golgi tendon organ equals inhibition relaxation when it gets stimulated in tension. Remember, GTO is about tension, spindle is about length. And that when that muscle contracts, its counterpart is inhibited, reciprocal inhibition. Okay? All right, let's remember that. Means I'm going to jump right to, since I've got that on your mind, I'm going to go right to here. How many are confused with PNF? Okay. So, PNF is called active stretching or facilitative stretching. This form of stretching integrates active muscle contractions into stretching maneuvers to inhibit or facilitate contraction. What did we just talk about? Muscle spindle contracts. Golgi tendon organ inhibits. We also had reciprocal inhibition. If this muscle contracts, its agonist is inhibited. This form of stretching integrates active muscle contractions into stretching maneuvers to inhibit or facilitate muscle activation. When that happens, we increase the muscle's ability to remain as relaxed as possible as it's stretched. Reflexive relaxation occurs during the stretching maneuvers as a result of autogenic or reciprocal inhibition. So I'm either stimulating the GTO to relax the muscle, or by contracting its agonist, I'm stretching it. And I know that's where you're all confused when I say that. I'll get to it. Oh, I will get to it. Okay? Inhibition leads to decreased tension in muscle fibers and therefore decreased resistance to elongation. So if I can get the muscle inhibited, it's going to stretch easier. Okay. Now I believe it's more involved with more complex mechanisms of sensorimotor stuff and vasoelastic adaptations of the muscle tendon unit and so forth. But we're not going to worry too much about that because we're not going to delve too deep in it, but we're going to be talking about the technique itself. So we can see here in the diagram that in this case, let's go with number one. The muscle contraction or stretch increases tension to the tendons. It then therefore is detected by the Golgi tendon organ, which we just talked about, correct? Okay, so we've increased tension. Two, muscle contraction stimulates sensory nerve signals that travel to the central nervous system on type 1B fibers. So the Golgi apparatus, or the Golgi tendon organ is stimulated, and it's sending a sensory message to the spinal cord. Everybody sees that in blue? Okay. Three, sensory neurons synapse with interneurons. So when we get to the spinal cord, there are pathways within the cord that go from one to the other. So we can see here, this is posterior, this is anterior. So this is a little conversation that occurs from the front to the back of the spinal cord. Robert's leaving because he knows all this stuff. All right, so the sensory messages come back here, and then there's a quick conversation because back here is sensory, up here is all motor, the entire spinal cord. Okay, back here is all sensory. All sensory information comes into this part of the spinal cord, and all motor stuff leaves the spinal cord here. No matter where you are in the spinal cord. Everybody understand that? Okay, so I need to send a message from one to the other within the spinal cord. That's why they're called interneurons. They speak within the spinal cord. Now that message has gone here to the motor neuron. So the sensory neurons synapse with interneurons, taking it from one part of the spinal cord to the other. And then interneurons inhibit this muscle, and interneurons stimulate that one. So two things are going to happen here. The negative message here stops the quadriceps from contracting, and the positive neuron here is sending a stimulatory message for the hamstring to contract. Yes? And that's all because of the Golgi tendon organ. So when tension goes up in the muscle we want to contract, the agonist, the Golgi tendon organ gets stimulated, and it sends a message to the spinal cord, my tension's going up. That message goes across the spinal cord and goes two places. One that will inhibit the antagonist to the agonist, and the second one continues the stimulation of the agonist that we wanted to contract in the first place. Questions? Yes. Okay. So we have three different kinds: hold relax or contract relax, agonist contraction, hold relax with agonist contraction. Is that the terms you guys are using? Contract relax. Okay. Okay. We used to do them in diagonal patterns. Now we do them in a single plane or opposite line the pull of a group of a muscle we identify. To perform PNF, your patient needs to have normal innervation and voluntary control of either the shortened muscle or the muscle on the opposite side of the joint. So if they got a nervous issue, like a neuron's damaged, like post-stroke, that kind of stuff, we don't do PNF on those muscles because we're playing with the nervous system when we do it, okay? This modality is designed for use on contractile structures, not the non-contractile structures. So you have to identify first it's contractile structure that's the problem, which, of course, is a muscle. if it's a tendon, sorry, if it's a ligament or a bone or something, it's not going to do anything for you. PNF is more effective when muscle spasm limits motion, less effective for stretching long-standing fibrotic tissues. So it doesn't work well if you've got something like a contracture. It's not going to work well in a contracture because, again, you're dealing with really non-contractile structures. So hold relaxed and contract relaxed. Which one do you guys use? Okay. So the range-limiting target muscle. The range-limiting target muscle. I forever want you to remember that. Who wants to come up? Who wants to lie here? Somebody. Okay. So in this case, we're going to say our range-limiting muscle is hamstrings. Okay? So through my assessment and my testing, I've discovered that one of the problems here is that Samantha's right hamstring is tight. Okay? So it's tight. So I've identified it. Okay? That's really important to understand. I've identified it. That's where I'm going to. So the range-limiting target muscle, hamstring right, is first lengthened to the point of tissue resistance or to the point of patient comfort and held. You guys have 10 seconds, right? Okay. Used to be 30, so 10 seconds. The lengthened muscle is slightly shortened, and then the patient performs a pre-stretch end range isometric contraction for 5 to 10 seconds. So we're going to take her into the stretch. Relax. Give it to me. Okay. Okay. Let me know when you feel stretch. We'll say there. Okay. We're going to say it's there. She's obviously flexible. Okay. We're going to say it's here. Okay. So what am I going to look for that I don't do? Well, we just talk about muscle spindle. I don't want to see spasm, right? If it's doing that, I take it back. I don't want that because the muscle spindle has been simulated. It's sending a message for contraction because we've gone too far. So I'm going to hold this. 10. Okay. I take it back ever so slightly, just a little bit to shorten it, and then I ask her to push against my hand, okay? 1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, correct? Okay. Relax. You always do your 5 to 10 second stretch at end range. Then I bring it back, and then I ask her to push against my hand. In this one. At the range I've got her in here, okay? Immediately after that, remember there's a refractory period. So something we haven't talked about before is immediately after a contraction, a muscle can't contract again. And you also get reciprocal inhibition, or you get inhibition because the Golgi tendon organ has been recording what? Tension, right. So now I've relaxed it. I go into the new range. Oh, there it is, and we're done. Okay? I hold that for... Right? And then do I take it back a little bit? Yes. Push against my hand. Right? Blah, 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 blah. Right? And then when she relaxes, I go into the new range. And I start all over again. When do I stop? No more gains. Correct. Okay? Then I'm done. Right? So what I'm doing there is I'm utilizing the Golgi tendon organ and tension. Right? I'm also using the direct period of time after contraction where a muscle can't contract again because it's too busy recharging its calcium and all those sorts of things we're going to talk about. To finish, the elongated muscle is to be held for 30 seconds. Did you guys do that? Yeah, okay. The patient does not need to perform a maximal isometric contraction of the end of the range limiting target muscle prior to the stretch. So, of course, what do we ask them to do for how strong? How strong do we ask them to contract? Oh, 10%, right? Good. And then, of course, the contraction should be submaximal. The patient should be breathing regularly throughout, so we don't want a Valsalva maneuver there. I'm assuming that one's easy and you all know it, correct? Nope. There is a video here you can look at. There are some, it's done a bit differently than what you're taught, but at least you can follow how it's working, right, in terms of what it looks like. So you may not want to pay too much attention to what the therapist is saying in there because it's not wrong what he's saying, but it's not the way we're following it here in the course, okay? Okay, great. Okay. Okay, so this is the one that everybody gets confused with. Agonist contraction. So, I've identified a problem muscle. What muscle is the problem? Hamstring. Okay. The term agonist refers to the muscle opposite the range-limiting target muscle. So I've identified that hamstring is tight. So what muscle am I going to contract? Quads, right? Now quads are going to contract. When quads contract, what's going to happen to hamstrings? They're going to inhibit. And that's the trick of agonist contract. Anybody here got really tight hammies? Come on up. Thanks. I just want them to see what happens. Okay. Now you understand? You've got to find that target muscle. You have to identify what the muscle is that's the problem, and then you have its antagonist contract. And because it's contracting, it is now the agonist. Correct. Yeah, I do. I didn't invent it. Okay, so we're going to come in here. Just relax. Let me know if I can... Give it to me. That's better. Okay, that's the end. Okay, so I'm now here. Okay, so now I'm going to concentrically contract the muscle opposite the range-limiting muscle that holds the end range for the last several seconds. So I'm going to do this and hold it for 10. Okay, and then I'm going to take it back a bit. I'm going to ask her in her straight leg to try to bring her toe to that wall. So your toe to that wall, moving your whole leg. Okay. And how long does she hold it for? 10 seconds, and then we relax. Take it back a bit. Okay, foot to the wall again. As far as you can, hold. And relax. In the cramp?
Yeah.
In your quad?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's gone now.
Okay. Right. And then again, see if we get any more change. Bring it towards... And relax, we're pretty much done there, right? Okay, so we started here, and we got to here. The key here is, again, you have to identify the muscle that's the problem, and it's its antagonist that works. And because it's the antagonist contracting, it becomes the agonist. It's agonist contract. We're having the antagonist contract, so therefore, because it's contracting, it is now the agonist.
Okay.
That makes sense now?
Yeah. Yeah, the light bulb finally
went on. Okay. So the whole key to the whole process is identifying the structure that's the problem and going from there. Let's have you set up for a sec. Okay, you can just have you swing towards them.
Sorry.
Towards them. Okay, so let's go with... You okay if I touch on your neck?
Okay.
So let's say I want to do middle scaling. Okay. So I'm going to go into stretch, hold it for my appropriate time, and then I'm going to ask the patient, could you please bring your left ear to your left shoulder? And that's it. Yeah. And relax. Okay. Try to bring your left ear to your left shoulder again. And that's about it, which is good, because all I have to do is this, and I can feel already how tight it is. It's very, very tight. And then relax. Okay? Now, if I want to do the other form, okay, so we're going to go into the stretch. Okay, push against my hand with your head. 1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, and relax. Okay, push against my hand. 1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, and relax. Relax, 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 relax. Good. And that's about it for that. We see the difference? All right. I am going to hold this for 30 seconds because if I don't, she's going to be sore. Okay, any questions there? So the other one is nothing more than the combination of both of them, correct? Yes? Good. You can relax. Come on back up. Okay. thanks. Yes. That's correct. In which one? Agonist contraction, and that's what I had her do. I took her into the stretch, then I dropped my hand and said, please move your foot to the wall. I let her move it, counted it to five, and then held the heel in the new place. And then let her relax, you know, bring it back just a touch. Please take your foot to the wall. She took her foot to the wall, count to five, pull it in the new place. I didn't push it. She did the movements. No, I don't believe. I'll talk to Michelle. Yeah, correct. Clenching your abdomen, right, to inhibit, and they pull down, right? So, yeah, they're moving, correct? You have to move. Okay, I will double check for you. Make sure of that. You're still putting them into, because you've got to find the end range, right?
Yeah.
So you're still passively putting them into the end range, but then they're moving after that.
Okay.
Right? Does that make sense? Right? Because even when we saw Amanda with her head, right, I put her into lateral flexion, and then I asked her to move, and she, the first time, she did move a couple of millimeters, right? Held it, and then I held it there, and then there was no more movement, which means, you know, that would be work we'd have to do. Yeah, come on up. This is the one that's quite often on OPs. Yes. It's 5 to 10. So, oh, what kind of posture is that? Good Lord. Okay, so SCM, right? Okay, so let's identify it's the right SCM. So what's the stretch? Contralateral lateral flexion and ipsilateral rotation. Okay, so that's the movement. Okay, so relax. So a good way to do it for stretch is I take both hands and hold here, here, and here. Feel a stretch?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to hold it for 10. So what I would like you to do in a moment, I want you to try to bring your right ear to your right shoulder and turn your nose to the left. Go ahead. 3, 4, 5, and relax. Correct. Okay. Yep. But I want her to turn to the left and flex to the left because that's the opposite. I'm making it work, right? So going away from it. Again, remember your attachments. Here's your mastoid process, and here is your... basically your clavicle sternum, okay? So turn to the left and bring your right ear to your right shoulder. Did I shorten it? Yes, so therefore that's contraction. If I want to lengthen it, turn to the right, tilt to the left, I'm getting them farther apart. That's the way to remember it. So your attachments are on contraction are always getting closer together, and on stretch they're getting farther apart. So if we go back to it again, okay, getting it farther apart, I want to turn this way, which takes the mastoid process farther away, and tilt this way, which takes the mastoid process even farther again, correct? Okay, now I'm going to ask her to turn to the left, which will bring the mastoid process closer, and tilt the right ear to right shoulder, which will bring the mastoid process closer, correct? So this is the stretch. Okay, try to turn to the left and bring your right ear to your right shoulder at the same time. Can you see your SCM sticking right out? And relax, and I take it in accordingly. You can do the same thing. Lie down for me. In case you get asked, you can do it this way as well, right? Sorry, your hair's underneath there. And give me your head. Just give me your head. Okay, can I do the same thing, right? I can go into lateral flexion and ipsilateral rotation. So by turning her head this way, I'm stretching her right. You can really feel it now, can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you see now? Okay, can you see her SCM is kind of stretching? Her scalings are really tight too, that's why they're sticking out. But this is her SCM right here, right? So you can kind of see it there. Okay? Thanks. Make sense? Kind of, sort of? In axial, though I talked earlier, in axial, when you're doing PNF, it's basically you want to stretch the right, the left works. You want to stretch the left, the right works. That's fundamentally what tends to happen. Or if it's a posterior muscle, you want them to go anterior. If it's an anterior muscle, you want them to go posterior. Right? Does that make sense? Manage your question? Because it got shortened. Yeah, not unusual. Yeah, you just take it out for a bit, give it a break, and it could be that there's something going on there that I would deal with massage techniques. It's probably a bit tight on its own. I didn't like it too much. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So does that make a little more sense now? No, don't. Okay, here's the thing students always have when they first learn. It's either black or it's white. You're going to discover in this course, and massage in general, it's never black and it's never white. It's always gray. Okay? There's so many different ways to do things, but for you guys in semester one, I just want to clarify which way Michelle wants to go, and then I'll get that set up. Because, again, when I was taught how to do agonist contract, I passively did it. That's how I learned. So she would contract, but I would also passively move her at the same time. That's how I learned. Yeah, like that. Well, that's what I want to find out for you guys, right? Like, so what, I can tell you this much, too, what happens in an OP. Let's just say I'm there, and I watch you do it with isometric contraction. I won't mark you right or wrong. We all go back to the initial teacher, which is Michelle, and say, Michelle, the students did this. Is this what they were taught? Yes. Okay, boom. Then you get the mark. So don't ever worry about that. Because we always go back and ask questions. Because sometimes things change, and I'm marking, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then if I see it once, I go, eh. If I see four or five of you come across the OP, and you're all doing it, I'm like, okay, they're doing something I don't know about here. So I go back and talk to Michelle about it. So it's no problem. Don't ever worry about that. Yeah, don't ever worry about that. Does that make more sense, though? It's always the target muscle. It's always the target muscle. And then you ask its antagonist to contract. Remember I told you when I just showed you where in the arc, right? So when the tension goes up, one message goes to continue contracting the muscle that we've isolated, which is the antagonist. But the inhibitory message is exactly what we're after. We want that inhibitory message to get to the target muscle to relax, and therefore you get lengthening. Does that make more sense? Yeah. We're just playing with the nervous system. Push against you with an isometric.
Yeah, and then you take them, you elongate a little bit.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And then until the end.
Right.
And then for the agonist contract, you have to identify what the opposite.
Correct.
Position. You get them into the position.
I lengthen it.
Yeah.
I provide.
And then you ask them to
continue the move, and I'm taking them in.
The length that they can do.
Correct.
And they come back, and then try again.
Not come back. I take them into the new range that they moved in through active contraction, and then I hold that for a count of five and ask them to move in again. Well, that's my understanding. I'm going to double check that too. That's how Michelle showed you as well. Yep. Now, right. So the question becomes, when to use it? If I have a muscle that's spasming really badly, I don't want it to contract. I'm going to have the antagonist contract, which is going to relax the spasming muscle. Therefore, I'll get elongation. Make sense? If it's just tight and it's, you know, kind of fascial, then I'll do contract relax because it's okay to stretch it out. Okay. Hold, relax, antagonist. Well, so in the case of hamstrings, right? So if we see here, move the limb to the point that tissue resistance is felt. The patient performs a resisted pre-stretch, and then, you want to see it? Okay. Callie, come on back up again. Come on back up again. Real quick. Yeah. It just closed, right? Hopefully it's not shattered. Good. Okay, so again, we'll stay with the right hamstring. So lay down on your back, head down this end. So I'm going to go with the right hamstring, okay? So I'm going to take it, relax, relax, relax. Okay, there's the stretch. Okay, there it is, right? So hold for 10, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so what you're going to do here in a moment, you're going to push against my hand for a count of 10. As soon as we're done the push, I want you to pull your leg towards the wall. Okay, so push against my hand. One, only, no, no, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, only about 10, 15%. Okay, okay. One, go ahead. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Pull your leg towards there. Wow, hey. Okay, we're going to hold it. Okay, push against my hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Pull your foot. Crazy, yeah? Okay, thanks. Shit works. Okay, so that's what you're doing. And what are you doing? Playing with the nervous system. Stimulating reciprocal inhibition, or inhibiting, and stimulating Golgi tendon organ to relax as well. That's ultimately what you're doing with PNF. But it's called proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation. Okay, good. But I will check on that isometric versus active, concentric, with the other one for sure. And there are videos there you can watch. As I said, you know, they use a little bit different, I think. I think they've got the 30-second hold in that, but that at the end of the day, as much as we're not necessarily doing that, you won't really get hammered if you hold for 30 seconds per se. At OSCEs or anything like that. Okay, what do we got left here? Aerobic. Okay, so next week we got aerobic, osteology, and muscle phys. I am going to take those two osteo slides and make them into one more condensed, more appropriate for us. So next week, be prepared. We're going to hit the ground running because we have to get through all that material. So we did pretty good today. Actually, all we have left is aerobic, which is fine. And we'll kind of go from there, okay? So there will be a quiz next week on this, what we got today, okay? See you guys next week. Last week, next week.